I'm Ajahn Brahm, and I now introduce Carol, who would introduce me.
Yeah, I think Ajahn is really wise because he knows that people like me would need some kind of introduction, but not Ajahn Brahm himself. Yeah, so he's really wise. And yeah, welcome you all again to this Day of Kindfulness organized by the Buddhayana International Foundation. And before the event begin, there are a few announcements. We have some question and answer. We have question and answer session in the afternoon. So if you have any questions, please make use of the paper that we provide, like at the back of the hall. And we have a basket for these questions. So you can drop in the basket and we'll present that to Ajahn for answer in the afternoon. And for those who haven't registered before you come into the hall, please go and do so like during break or during lunch outside. And vegetarian lunch will be served at around 11:30. And we'll also have a session to make offering to Ajahn if you wish. And we have some red packet, lycee packet at the back of the hall. And so I think I would prefer to save more time for Ajahn to give his teaching. And in fact, I'm very happy for you all because today is actually like approaching the end of the teaching tour for Ajahn in Hong Kong this time. So you all are very wise that you have grabbed this precious opportunity. And so without further ado, please join me to give a big hand to warmly welcome Ajahn Brahm.
And also in the Buddhist calendar, it's a full moon day today. So that's even more powerful. But anyway, to learn to do some meditation. Meditation is like leaving the world for a few minutes, or maybe even longer, to get some perspective on life. And the story which comes up, as a young man in 1969, I was 18, I was hitchhiking through United States, and I got so bored with United States, it just looked similar to every other place I'd been to. And I went to a library and saw these amazing pyramids in the middle of the jungle, in the borders between Guatemala and Mexico, in the Yucatan Peninsula. And so I decided, as an adventure, to go and visit those great pyramids. And it took me about 3 or 4 days from Guatemala City to be able to trek through the jungle, along rivers, on the back of lorries. There was no other transport to get to this complex of pyramids in the middle of the rainforest in southern Mexico and Guatemala. And when I got there, there was hardly anyone around. The only person I saw was maybe one archaeologist doing archaeologist thing. And when I was there, there was no security, no guards, no place you can get a cup of tea or coffee or something. It was just abandoned. And so I was 18, a boy, and I did what most 18-year-old boys would have done. I saw one of those pyramids and climbed it. And they're very tall. But I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't do any research. All I knew, this was an ancient civilization which had disappeared even before the Spanish conquistadors came in. And because I'd been traveling through the jungle for 3 or 4 days, and because my mind was clear of theories or knowledge, when I got to the top, it was really plain to see the meaning of those big pyramids in the jungle. Because I've been traveling for 3 days in rainforest that you never saw far distances. The paths, the rivers, they wound around inside the jungle, and if they did clear any trees, the rainforest was so alive. The trees grew new branches so quickly. So wherever you traveled, it was like traveling in tunnels covered with greenery. I never realized, but I hadn't seen the sky for about 3 or 4 days. I hadn't seen far distances for that time. I'd been in the tunnels, snaking through the jungle. And so when I got to the top of that pyramid, it was above the tree line. For the first time in 3 or 4 days, I could see far distances, like seeing infinity without anything between me and the far distant reaches of the infinite. Also, above there, above the jungle, there was wind coming through. It was so cool and refreshing above the tree line. And lastly, as I looked down on the jungle, you could make out the path of the rivers and the little roads where I had traveled 2 days before. Before the days of Google Maps or Google Earth, there you had the forest, the jungle spread out before you, so you could figure out how everything fat together. And to me, the simile was so clear. I imagined some priest, it was the Mayan civilization, some priest taking a young man or a young woman up the pyramid for the first time in their lives. Imagined this young man or young woman who'd never seen beyond the patch of jungle where they were born, grew up and lived, and now for the first time going up to see the world in which they lived spread out in front of them. They could get an understanding of the relationship between their villages and the rivers and how it all fit together in that Google Maps view. And they could feel the freshness of the air when they were outside, above, beyond the jungle. And lastly, they could see forever. They weren't clouded, they weren't hindered just by the trees in front of them. And the simile was that in our life, we are just in a jungle of duties, problems, things to solve, bills to pay, relationships to fix, health issues. We're in a jungle of so much busyness. And imagine that we could find a pyramid, and we climb up to the top of that pyramid, and we just see how all of our life's problems, activities, things which frustrate us, things which inspire us, how it all fits together and has a meaning for us. And up there, outside of the busyness and the closeness of all the things we have to do in the day, we get fresh air, refreshing, cool, re-energizing, and lastly, we can see forever, see the infinite with nothing between us and that which people call spirituality. You know that sometimes, please excuse me, but religions especially, we put blocks between the infinite and the person. Someone you've got to go through before you can actually see forever. And That's not what Buddhism should ever be. Buddhism, like the Buddha said, takes your hand, shows you the way, and then off you go. We're not going to tell you what you have to see or how to interpret it, but to give you that freedom to see as you experience it. So, the meaning of that simile of the pyramids, which I've used extensively, stands for meditation. To get some perspective on your world, on your life. You know how complicated it can be sometimes? And even in my life, what am I supposed to do next? You do this one, you do the next one, the next one, the next one, and the next one. It just gets so entangled, life. And you're trying your best to solve the problems and help and look after people, look after yourself. But life gets very sort of, really entangled is the best word. All sticky. And like those old strings which get entangled and you have to spend hours trying to untangle them. But in meditation, we just leave that world. We go up and beyond to get some perspective about your life, death, your health, your relationships, your work. What's it all about? You can do that because you've left it, you're above it, you're beyond it, and you're seeing like above. And you get refreshment. In meditation, it's like you can breathe. You've got no problems. You don't have to force the brain to keep coming up with ever new solutions. And lastly, you can actually see above and beyond the jungle of our lives. To see how it all fits together. The boundless infinite, which embraces everybody. Not separates, but embraces. So this is what we learn in meditation. How to get away from it all. Just for a short while. How to get some breathing space. How to get perspective. How to be able to see our health, emotional and physical, and our life's journey in a smart, wise, kind, realistic way. So in order to climb that pyramid inside, we do have these little processes called meditation, mindfulness, or kindfulness, whatever you wish to call it. But to be able to leave our usual normal world, it's why we take a day off work and we turn off our mobile phones. I haven't made that point first. If you have a cell phone, a mobile phone, an iPhone, or something which goes beep beep, please turn it off. It's not the end of the world if you don't answer your emails for one day. And even it's not just one day, it's only for until 4 p.m. And what you're doing is just showing that the iPhone is a servant of you. That you use that when you want to, rather than you being a servant of your iPhone. There was that story which I said already during this teaching tour of the boy at school who was asked to do an essay of what he wants to be when he grows up. He was only about eight or nine or something. And he wrote, "When I grow up, I want to be an iPhone." And the teacher said, "Why? Explain." And he replied, "Well, whenever I go home, I try to get my daddy's attention and play with him or just be with him. And he's always on his iPhone." He said, "A bit later, I've got some messages I've got to check. And my mum too, she's always on her iPhone. In fact, my parents spend so much time, so many hours on their iPhones, I thought if I became an iPhone, I would be closer to my mum and dad and they would spend more time with me. And I think you all get that message. So, as I mentioned in a talk last night even, over in Silicon Valley, I go around all sorts of places. And when I went there a few years ago to give talks at Google and Facebook and stuff like that, I just missed one of their conferences in which they said the title of the conference was Disconnect to Connect. So if you want to connect with your body, with your mind, with peace, with happiness, with life, disconnect from your devices. So you can connect with your body, your health, with your mind, with your emotions, with peace, and later on, to connect with the people you love. Disconnect to connect. So, having made that point, if any of your mobile phones or cell phones go off during this talk or during the meditation, we say that your mobile device makes bad karma. Even technology makes bad karma, because in its next incarnation, it will be reborn as the speed camera, which causes many fines and much suffering to people, or it might even be reborn as a parking meter. These, in my opinion, are the two lowest forms of technology. So you turn off your phones, and so you can connect. So you're connecting with what? First of all, to connect with your body. You know, many people have sickness here and sickness there because they're not connected to their body. When I was a young monk in Thailand, you know, we wouldn't have sandals. If we did manage to get one, they would soon wear out. We'd have to fix them with bits of string, literally. And so a lot of the time, we were walking around without any coverings on our soles of our feet, no shoes. And the Thai monks, they were fine walking around without any shoes or sandals. As Western monks, we were always stubbing our toes, treading on thorns. Our feet were just covered with bruises and cuts and band-aids. And when Ajahn Chah saw this, you know, in his own inimitable way, he used a form of language which I'd never heard before. He said, "You Westerners have got stupid feet." So he wasn't saying we were stupid, but our feet were. And you could see the evidence, the cuts and bruises and band-aids. And so, what does it mean by having stupid feet? It means you're not paying any mindfulness of them, taking them for granted, thinking they'll be okay because you're not aware of them. Sometimes we've got stupid hearts, which is why we get cardiac problems. We get stupid hands, which is why, you know, we burn ourselves sometimes. You can see what the meaning was, that sometimes our mindfulness and our intelligence is focused somewhere, you know, behind our ears, and we're not really aware even of our own bodies and what we're doing. So the first part of meditation, to connect with your body and learn just how she works. How do your body feel? You have a cough. What should you do? Stop coughing? In meditation, we have the phenomena called volcano effect. Volcano effect in meditation is this: when we start meditating, you want to cough, but you decide to suppress it. to stop it, to bung it up, to knock off, because you feel that you don't want to hurt or harm or disturb the people around you. And what happens? The pressure builds and builds, and you know it's going to explode, but you still try and suppress it. And the longer and the more power you suppress your little cough, when it does blow, you can hear it over the whole campus. Worse, you'd really disturb people, but worse, just like when a volcano explodes, they have all this toxic gas, covers the villages surrounding. And for you, when you cough, all this toxic spray goes around everybody around you. That's stupid. You want to cough? Just cough. It's much more healthy. So to avoid the volcano. So what we're doing, we're learning about our body, how it works. And just simple kindness is the best way to have a healthy body for you and all the people around. So we learn how to relax our body. When I was recently over in Korea, giving an event in the demilitarized zone, about 6,000 South Koreans were attending. And South Koreans, the culture, there's nothing wrong with the culture, but they can be so tense. When they go to a retreat, they like the Zen master whacking them on the back. I don't know what they do that for, it's crazy. But anyway, that's what they do. So they're just so tight and tense. And even when I went on to interviewing in the Korean TV channel, I was talking with the presenter beforehand, just chatting like we're doing now. But once, you know, you got the red light and we were on air, is there any Koreans here, by the way? Oh, good. So you won't get offended. As soon as he actually was on air, he wasn't like usually friendly anymore. He got a straight back and he said, "Today we are very fortunate to have the Venerable Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm, what do you think about South Korea?" Please excuse me, but that was just like the culture, you know, you're just going to be powerful and forceful. But, you know, it took me a while to get that. I thought, you know, what's going on? What have I done wrong? So when I saw 6,000 and they wanted a quick parting teaching on meditation, can you please say a few words on how to meditate in brief? So I told them, and I had a translator, the translator sitting next to me, I said, "Relax. Translate, please." And they translated into Korean, "To the max." And he translated that, so he knew what it meant. Now, together, and 6,000 South Korean meditators of the Jokjae Zen order, "Relax." They all chanted, "To the max," they continued. And they felt some peace, some happiness, some stillness. It was teaching people, by example, how to meditate. If you are tight and tense, how does your body feel? It's not pleasant. But when you relax, things flow through your body, you're at ease, and the body can relax so much you can attend to your mind. Even when you go to sleep at night, many people find difficulty having a good night's sleep because they are so tense. And they carry the difficulties and disappointments of the day in their body. They can feel it with some tightness somewhere. And they carry the anxieties of the tomorrow in their body as well. Feels all tight and tense. You can't go to sleep with a body as tight like that, which is why you relax. And sometimes I wonder, why do I have to teach this? Relax. Don't you know how to do that? You would have thought that's one of the basic skills of being a human being. When it's time to work, wow, you work. When it's time to rest, you relax. That way you become a very efficient, healthy, productive member of the human race. So, first part of meditation, becoming aware of our body, learning how to relax it. And it's amazing what you can do when you relax the body. This is the anxiety example. One disciple over, well, she wasn't really a disciple at first, but my goodness, she is now, that she had chronic severe anxiety disorder. She was at university in Adelaide. She was so anxious that she was bedridden. She couldn't get out of the room. She was very fortunate that she had a boyfriend who would do everything for her. You know, wash, cook, look after her. Imagine a boyfriend like that. Whew. But anyway, she couldn't go to any classes. And even the free medical care, psychologist, psychiatrist, no one could help. She was bedridden. And then her uncle was a disciple in Perth. So he told her to call me. Got nothing to lose because I'm cheap. It's true, I don't charge anything. Really good value for money, Buddhist monks and nuns. Even this retreat today, I was talking with Jasmine earlier, and just to tell you that this retreat, if you don't like it, you can ask for your money back. You got that from me, so you know that I can't lie. So you always, if you anything you don't like about this retreat, you can ask for your money back. That's my guarantee, promise. You won't get your money back, but you can ask for it.
I promise. I should have been in business. I'm very sneaky.
But anyway, there she was, and I just called her. Oh, she called me. And when you have anxiety, it's an emotional problem, but it's manifested on your body somewhere. Every emotional feeling has a corresponding feeling on your physical body. Check it out. So when you are anxious, number one, where does it manifest on your body? And she said, in my chest. She said, not good enough. I said, I wanted coordinates. You know, millimeters from your navel, to the left, to the right. How big? Is it a circle? Is it an oval? Sort of, you know, the area of your body, which is tight, whatever, when you have an anxiety attack, a panic attack, exactly where is it? And I said, well, I said, give me a call in a couple of days when you can answer my question. It wasn't just procrastinating, just because, you know, I have lots of other people to talk to. But it was also, I was giving her a time, something to do while she was bedridden, so she could investigate her anxiety, exactly where it manifests. And then after 3 days, you know, she said exactly where it was. I said, how does it feel? Describe it. And she said, well, you know, it's just tight, it's tense. Not good enough. Give me another call in 2 or 3 days, when you can almost like write a 2-page essay about the feelings. And all I was doing here, I wanted her to be really mindful of that feeling in her chest when she had a panic attack. Not just it was around my chest somewhere, or it was painful or tight. I wanted her to really investigate, to really get to know it, so that she could describe it to someone a long distance away in detail. And when she did that, I realized, okay, now you are mindful. Now the next thing to do, when you have such a panic attack, is to take your hand and just massage that area, the whole area which is manifests the anxiety and the panic in your body, massage it with as much kindness as you possibly can. And I said, you know, being a bit of a cheeky monk, said, if you feel too tired to massage it, ask your boyfriend. I'm sure he will oblige. And so that's what she did. She called in a few days later. How did it go? Following the instructions? Yes, she said. Every time I had a panic attack, my chest became tight. I knew the area. I massaged it. I said, well, what happened? And she said, well, when I massaged my chest area, the tightness disappeared. You know, the pain, the ache, just slowly, slowly, slowly vanished. And I said, good. Now, once the physical feeling vanished, what happened to your emotion of panic, anxiety? And I will never forget, there are moments in life where you really, yes, which you'll take to your grave. If I'm in a grave, or maybe into my funeral pyre. Or actually, I was deciding that modern monks, in modern times, you know, just being buried or being cremated, that's bad for the environment. So I wanted to be mulched. You know, a mulcher, and then you put it on the garden? That's by far the best way to dispose of a body. So my last will and testament will be to be mulched. Will you let me do that? But anyway, you know what I'm talking about, mulching. You know, you get the garden waste, you put it in this big machine, it goes round and round and round, and you get sort of little twigs and leaves and grass all ready to put on your garden. What a wonderful thing that would be. Anyway, so, so what happened to the emotion? Because she went quiet. It's those moments when you're doing any teaching, it's the eureka moment, the light bulb moment. Someone actually gets it. Said the emotion went, the panic disappeared with the physical manifestation. Yup. So carry on. She now had her way through mindfulness, basically, and some kindness to transcend her anxiety and panic disorders. And a couple of weeks later, she was out of bed, back to university. Graduated first class honours in dentistry, and 3 months later she made all the arrangements. She came over to Perth because she wanted me to do the marriage blessing for her and her boyfriend Lloyd. And I just love that, because you'd actually save somebody's life, and they wanted you to be there just to do the chanting and stuff for their marriage. And of course, they always come now. They've got a couple of kids. Just great dentist or dentist technician. And she knows panic disorder and how it can be overcome. These are examples. When you get to know your body, it's amazing what you can do with it. You have abilities, not psychic abilities, scientific abilities, to understand every emotion has a corresponding physical feeling. Don't try and deal with the emotions. Deal with their manifestations. Relax the body and the fears, anxieties, even pain, which is mostly emotional can also disappear. So what we do in meditation, we learn about our bodies and learn how to relax them. And so a lot of your physical stuff vanishes, but that's only the start of it. Then you can actually get into your mind. What is your mind? So, to understand what the mind is, can't go past one of my friends from university. You always have two or three or four close friends. And I've already made a lot about one of my close friends. He was the first Buddhist I ever met. He was on the store. You know, just like they have stores out there, you know, they're taking your registrations. This was joining up the Cambridge University Buddhist Society. And I never knew that such an organization existed. So as soon as I went up there and I saw, wow, this is actually a Buddhist society, a club in the university. Wow, I'm going to join this because I've been a Buddhist for a while, but I never knew what to do or where to go. So I said, I want to join. And this guy said, you don't have to. You know, it's Buddhism. It's just free and easy. You know, you want to come, you can come. You don't have to. You know, you don't have to do anything. Just come and see, check it out. He said, no, look, I'm a Buddhist. I want to join. He said, no, look, come to a couple of the talks. After a couple of talks, if you like it, then you can pay. And I got a £1 note out, which was the joining fee. Slammed it on the table. I said, join me now. And he became a lifelong friend. And he's emeritus professor, Bernard Carr, emeritus professor of theoretical physics, very close student of Stephen Hawking's. So close that Stephen went to Brian's wedding, so Bernard's wedding, and also that Bernard was featured in the movie of the brief, the history of time. Theory of Everything, yeah. Which was the biopic of Stephen Hawking. So he was the first Buddhist I ever met. But our other friend was a fellow called Jeff Perry. And he was, for quite a few years, just before 1999, he was a consul, British consul at Macau. So he actually speaks, Mandarin, I think, is his speciality. But anyway, it was like the three amigos, we hang out together. And the other thing which we all, the other society we also joined, was the Psychic Research Society. We went around, we went hunting ghosts, looking for them. Heard any ghosts anywhere, and we were right there straight away at night time with all the machines and trying to catch photos of ghosts. Because we're scientists, investigating. But anyway, Jeff's daughter, she was 5, 6 years of age, first year in primary school, grade one, maybe say here. And that's when the teacher asked them a question. What is the biggest thing in the world? My daddy, said one girl. No, elephant, said another. No, a mountain is the biggest thing in the world. And then the daughter, I don't mind saying it, I think Samantha, her name was. Samantha put her hand up and said, my eye is the biggest thing in the world. My eye. What do you mean? Well, she said, my eye can see her daddy. It can see an elephant and a mountain and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye must be pretty big. And thank goodness for kids, young kids who haven't been taught how to think. So their mind is actually free to explore and think in ways that other people just don't see. She was later I mentioned to people, did, I always get this wrong, biophysics, or I think it was biophysics in Oxford. Got a PhD. But she was a bit genius, seeing things in a different way. But what has that to do with the mind? The mind is far bigger than the eye. Because your mind can see everything your eye would ever see. And will imagine, can imagine things that you can't see in the real world. It can hear, it can smell, taste, touch real and imaginary objects. And it's got its own area of knowledge. Everything you can ever experience can fit into your mind. Therefore, your mind is the biggest thing. Not in the world, because the world and the universe can fit into your mind. Da da da. QED, as they used to say in universities. Quid est demonstrandum. It's a Latin word which says, see, disprove that if you can. No one's been able. So what we're doing here is the mind is huge. So this is what we're going to look at next after relaxing the body. We're going to the big stuff, your mind. So how can we get a handle on this mind so we can actually calm it down or get to know it? So just really sort of enhancing the practice of meditation and kindfulness and mindfulness. I just worked out to look at that part of your mind which shows you how peaceful or how agitated you are. If you want to find out how hot or cool this room is, you look at the thermometer. If it's a bit cold for you, you can actually, you know, turn up the temperature on the air conditioner so you can get some feedback. Once you can measure, you've got an idea of how to manipulate and make it comfortable. Speedometer, you can know whether you're over the limit and get in trouble with the police. So we have meters which give us feedback. So I invented the term peace-ometer. How peaceful are you inside right now? Because it's a personal measurement, you can be honest. You don't have to try and please other people. How peaceful are you right now? And to make it easier, give it a number from 1 to 10. 1 is really peaceful. 10 is agitated. 0 is dead. So no good. Sometimes I say these things every now and again just to get people awake. You know, say something ridiculous and then people laugh and then I can carry on with the talk. So you've got 1 to 10. And once you know how peaceful you are, what changes that level of peace? What makes you more agitated and disturbed? And what makes you more peaceful? Now that is the important point here of this exercise. You are learning what disturbs you and how to calm yourself down no matter what you're experiencing. Trial and error, but to help. So you don't waste too much time with your peaceometer. You find that simple things like being in the present moment and just letting the past go for a while. You don't have to abandon it forever. Just put it on the back burner. After meditation is finished, you can just pick it up. Or the future. What's going to happen? I will tell you that what you think is going to happen never does. It's always something much worse.
That's only joking.
Sometimes it's unexpected, much better, but you don't know. It's never how you feel it's going to happen. So anyway, what that means is that we can put aside the past and the future. And that is a simile of climbing up the mountain, up the pyramid, getting outside the busyness of the jungle. So with the past and the future, all your plans and all your memories. And also, you'll find that thinking too much. Don't any scientists here. I was taught, drummed into me, in experimental physics, you had to just do the experiment and record the data and not trying to think about the data. If you started thinking about it and getting conclusions before all the data was in, you'd skew the data. So it's the same with meditation. You don't think. Leave that till afterwards, when you can review your experiences. But right now, we find that thinking disturbs your peace. And once you've noticed that, it's easy to let go of thinking. As I mentioned in a talk last night, it's so easy to know silence. It's what you were aware of in those spaces between my words. And once you can experience silence, you can know how attractive, how profound, sacred it is. Pretty easy. And you find giving attention to the silence takes the needle of your peaceometer way down. You really are peaceful. So what that does in this meditation is you find just how the mindfulness in the right places can actually relax your body, make it so peaceful and healthy, and then relaxing your mind, making that just so still and wonderful. It's not effort anymore. It's just learning how just to be and not do stuff. Getting out of the jungle of our world and getting this beautiful, refreshing, clear air. And then you can see forever in the peaceful stillness of your mind. That is basic what meditation is. Any questions? Good. Sometimes it's another trick, so we don't get too many questions at the wrong time. We teach people how to be very still and calm, and I get you to be so peaceful that even your questions get suppressed by the peacefulness which you put out there. So anyway, the best thing to do now then is to do some exercise of meditation, some practice. So we're just going to do maybe 20-minute practice of meditation. Then afterwards we have a little bit of a toilet break, those people who need to let go. But in the meantime, we're going to do a 20-minute meditation to start with. If everybody would like to get up and stretch. Just that it helps your body, especially at my age. To be able to I think I tell this every year, but in the northeast of Thailand, old men were called Mr. Oi, and old women, Mrs. Oi. And when we ask, where did that name come from? They say, well, at a certain age, whenever you move, you always go, Oi. Oi. So Mr. Oi and Mrs. Oi, and now Ajahn Oi. Oi. And when you feel that you've stretched a little bit and you feel okay, then you can sit down. And you can meditate in a chair. I usually like meditating on the floor, but today I haven't got any. I'm going to meditate. No. I refuse. Excellent. No. I'm going to sit on a chair out of compassion to show it can be done. You know, as a monk one day, I have to be really careful not to say I like a certain type of food. Because I did that years ago. And the next day, I think it was in this particular part of north of Thailand, it was like a battered fried banana. I said, oh, that's really nice. And the next day, that's all I got. For my one meal of the day, a bowl full of battered fried banana. Nothing else, no rice, no curry, nothing else, just battered fried bananas. So that really serves me right. So just no preferences. Anyway, so you better not forget that, Gerald, or Carol, who's going to give me lunch today. So no battered fried bananas, okay. So anyway, sitting down. And if you're on the floor, get yourself into a good position. For those of you, a few people, it's quite okay to lean against the wall. Yes, a couple of people already figured that one out. One of the best meditation postures is leaning against the wall. You can put your feet out if you want to. And close your eyes. The reason we close the eyes is because we can be more sensitive to the body. It seems that the dominant sense is sight. So if we can just close that one down, we've got more gigabytes in our brain to process feelings in our body, sensations. So the eyes closed, you check your legs. You're aware of your legs. How are you doing down there, legs? You're not going to have stupid feet and stupid legs. You're going to check them out. So you're putting your mindfulness, your awareness, a long way away from your brain. The furthest distance, even to your toes. So with your eyes closed, can you experience your toes? You can flex them, wiggle them. You can feel them. Are they safe? Are they comfortable? If they're not, do something about it. How are your feet? Where are they? If you're sitting on a chair, sometimes I check, should I tuck my feet further under the chair or move them out, move them apart? What makes my legs more comfortable? This is caring for your body. Then I move up to my lower legs, my calves. How are they? You feel like the tingling, the tension, not tension, or the throb of the blood in my calves. My knees? How are my knees? Just make sure that my robe isn't tight around the knees. Your thighs? Your butt? And it is useful to pause around the bottom feeling. Sometimes I just can't give it a name, which is wonderful because I can be aware without giving things labels. But I can feel it, and I can fidget now out of kindness to make sure my bottom does not need to be moved for the rest of the meditation. Then I go up to my back. Well, this is an area where people have so many physical problems. So I get to know my back. It's an important part of my body. Until you almost become an expert on my own back, how it feels, how to relax it, how to ease tension, not make more pressure. In particular, my back is slumped at this moment, but I'm now going to stretch it. That feels good. Once it's stretched, I find the optimum position for my back. I feel it. I'm not concerned about what it says in books. I feel it. Today, it feels good just like this. I'm getting to know my body and caring for it. And then I look at my shoulders. Actually, they're quite tight. How do I relax them? I just imagine two strong men pulling aside the muscles on my left shoulder, stretching them, putting them under strain. And then I imagine those two strong men letting go of both ends of my shoulder muscles, of my left shoulder. And when I imagine this, I can feel the muscles actually get loose. Visualization, imagination works. And I imagine the muscles in my right shoulder, which aren't as tense. And I let them go at both ends as well. Everything becomes relaxed to the max. And then I move down my arms to my hands, making sure all of those muscles are similarly comfortable. And I go up to my throat to make sure I don't have a stupid throat. If I need to cough, I cough. Sometimes I just stay with an irritation. I just be kind. And noticing the feelings of irritation can get less once I know feedback. You do something and get the feedback, is this working? Another feedback of being in this moment and being silent. And then back up to the eyes and mouth. Just like the girl who got to know the feeling in her chest, the corresponding feeling of the emotion of anxiety. There's many corresponding feelings to emotions you can find on your face, around your eyes and mouth. So I notice any tightness, tension around my eyes, on my brow, forehead, or around my mouth. And I learn to relax all of those feelings or sensations. Until there's calm, peace in my face. And then I remember that 2 inches behind my eyes is my brain. And even though I was taught you can't feel any sensations in your brain, I'm going to imagine some. Imagine the tiredness, the exhaustion of a brain which has been working for days. And I don't want to work it now. So I imagine taking my brain and putting it on a cushion. A soft, deep, comfortable cushion. And telling my brain to relax to the max. It doesn't have to think. It doesn't have to solve problems. It doesn't have to be smart or clever. For the next 5 or 10 minutes, my brain can just take time out. And I relaxed my whole body. And I am aware of it as a unit, all connected together. Relaxing it as deeply as I can. This is part of meditation, and it is something which would lead you in a few moments to even further inside the peace of the body and the mind. But first I just enjoy the delight of a relaxed body. Then I go to my peaceometer. How peaceful am I? From 1 to 10. And I notice what makes my mind more peaceful, what makes it agitated. You can check it out, past, future, thinking. That makes my mind more agitated. Present moment and stillness. My mind becomes so calm. So can you see the needle of your peaceometer go up or go down? The feedback is important. It helps you learn from your own experience directly. And if you want to look at another meter, sleepy or bright, fine. How sleepy are you? How alive are you? What changes things? Until you learn from your own experience how to energize a sleepy mind.
So how peaceful are you? Now, if you wish, you can start observing your breathing. Breathing in peace without let go. Allowing your awareness to settle on the vehicle called your breathing. And the advantage of being mindful of your breathing is there's not much you can say about your breath. You can't give it much of a description. All you know is it's going in or going out, that's all. So it gives the opportunity for a stable object to watch, which is easy and which gives you a sense of calm. How does it feel now? How do you feel now? How relaxed is your body? How peaceful is your mind? Have you been observing your breathing, just breathing in and breathing out? So I'm now going to ring the gong. So I'll ring the gong 3 times. When the gong finishes sounding, it's a signal to come out for meditation. Usually I don't like bells, but today I did away with no bell silence. So, how was that? If you think you needed to get jhanas, you get frustrated. If you felt that you shouldn't have gone to sleep, you would have got frustrated. But in meditation, we're learning how to be peaceful, to be calm, rather than be a control freak. So if you did go to sleep, fine. No worries, mates, as we say in Australia. Because what happens is when we first start meditating, you know, we do just let go and we catch up with some sleep with somebody outside. Hi, you can come in outside. They're peeking. So, any questions or comments about the meditation so far? When I started meditating, I would be really sleepy. And I wondered why. I tried everything, even the matchbox trick. Because sometimes you don't know you're asleep. So what I would do, meditating, I'd put a matchbox on top of my head. Just the tray without the cover. And you put it on top of your head. Because if you started getting sleepy and nodding, it would fall off and onto the floor. And it only took a few days. Now that gave me some feedback, I knew if I was sleepy or not. And after a while, the matchbox could stay up there for a whole hour, didn't fall off at all. And that was when one of my fellow monks took me aside and said, Ajahn Brahm, you're still sleepy. You're still nodding, but now instead of nodding like this, you're nodding like this. And that was just really frustrating. I was trying my best and it wasn't working. And so, the thing which, again, gave me a lot of understanding and insight was then, this was meditating in the jungles. And we'd have to get up at 3 o'clock every morning. So number one, we were sleep deprived. Number two, we were eating disgusting food. It was disgusting food. Okay, disgusting food stories. We'd have a bowl of sticky rice. It's only one meal a day. Bowl of sticky rice, and one day all we had was a frog on top of the sticky rice. And I said, I used to be a vegetarian before I was a monk, but this was subsistence. This was, you had to eat what the villagers ate. And you had a frog on top of your sticky rice. And it wasn't, not salted, no sort of flavor, no chili. It was just boiled frog, just like the frog had gone into the pot, got boiled, and put on your rice. Now, I think that's disgusting.
what's going to happen next. At that time, you know, as a kid, you know, you tell your children, oh, you must pay attention at school. And something, ah, just, what are you paying attention for? You never need that later on in life. I wondered what I needed, why I needed to learn biology. But I did pay attention to biology. The monk sitting next to me, he never paid attention at all. He didn't know one part of the anatomy from another. So after eating some of the meat from the frog's legs, that wasn't enough to keep you going. So he started picking at its organs. And the monk sitting next to me, not knowing what he was pressing, pressed the frog's bladder. It still had urine in it, and the frog peed all over the monk's rice. And that is absolutely true. And no matter how hungry you are, you can't eat after that. So we were malnourished, and I was in a climate I wasn't used to. It was in the jungles, it was humid, it was hot. And I was struggling so much to overcome my tiredness. And then what happened was went down to Bangkok to renew your visa. And we managed to get a monastery, a very wealthy monastery. They had one of the first air-conditioned rooms. This was in 1975 or 6 or something. And so we used to get up early in the morning at 3 a.m. No one else would use that room at 3 a.m. in the morning, you know, forest monks. So we got the key. We went in there 3 o'clock in the morning before arms round to meditate. Perfectly awake. No sleepiness at all. And I realized that you were sleepy because the weather, I was not used to it. It was malnourished and not enough sleep. It was normal, it was natural. And with all the respect in the world to, you know, the great teacher, the Buddha, I really think if the Buddha was born in London, he would maybe fall asleep many times, you know, in the jungles of India. It's nature. So because of that, you don't feel, oh, I feel really a failure, I can't just meditate, I always fall asleep. No. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle. And what happens is that once all of the sleep deficit is paid off, you know, you've been nodding enough. Once the energies start to come up, once the body adjusts to the heat or the cold, then you become alive. The sleepiness starts to disappear. The energies start to come up. You become alive, awake, but peaceful. And that's the cool part. You've, you know, worked through the body acclimatizing, getting some energy up, and then when you meditate, whoa, so easy. So don't be afraid of sleepiness. Even sometimes, that if you're really sleepy, that's one of the reasons why monks prefer sitting on the floor, because if you're sitting on a chair, sometimes you may nod so much, you can even fall over. Which is why in long retreats we do have chairs with seat belts. It's only a joke, but I thought of that many times. So you can't fall off. But anyway, also those of you who know me know you always make a lot of fun when you're meditating. You just do become light-hearted. And of course that's also, that gives you energy. Because sometimes meditating or listening to a talk is so
boring. Why do I have to listen to this again? And it sends you to sleep. It reminds me of a story of this priest. Let's say a monk. This monk who was having a very difficult time, you know, paying the bills for the temple. No one would put any donations in the donation box. So he went to a senior monk, and the senior monk said, oh yeah, the same happened to me when I first started being a monk. You know, it's hard. But he said, how I got donations from my temple, he said, when I started out, that once everybody was in the room, I'd make sure the temperature of the aircon was high, and I'd close all the windows, make it stuffy, so people would start to fall asleep. And I would also, he said, speak in a monotone, so boring, no change of the tone of my voice, until people got so bored, they started to fall asleep. But before they fell asleep, he said he got out his watch and started swinging it. Until everybody in the hall was hypnotized. And once they were hypnotized, then he would say, before you leave, you will put a donation in my donation box, but no coins. No fives, tens or fifties, only hundreds. And the junior monk said, I can't do that, that's fraud. He said, no, it's encouraging good karma. So he tried it, and it really worked. He made a fortune. And the next time he needed some money in his temple, did the same. He turned up the heating in the hall, made it really stuffy, gave a boring sermon. When they're about to fall asleep, he got out his watch, started swinging it. But he dropped it. He dropped his watch and it broke. And just, you know, he just blurted out, oh shit. And it took them a couple of weeks to clean up the mess in his hall. Oh, somebody got it, thank you. So it serves the buck right. That's not how you do things. But nevertheless, sometimes sleepiness is just cause and effect. So don't worry about sleepiness. Restlessness, whoa, that's a bit more difficult. So to restless, just learn how to value stillness, silence. But why is it that when people, why is it they like thinking so much? One of the reasons is that when you were at school, now, sometimes it might have happened to you, I'm sure it happened to me many times. The teacher said, what do you think about that? I said, nothing. And they gave me a bad mark for that. Because to be smart, you've got to think. I could have been enlightened so much faster if I hadn't had to think when you were a kid. Because sometimes thinking, if you don't think, people assume you're stupid. Have you ever noticed some people, their thinking process hasn't been that developed, but certainly they have a lot of emotional wisdom. They can feel, they can know. Which is one of the reasons why our society, we emphasize thinking too much. So we can't stop thinking, we're addicted to thinking. Even that little on one of the bags outside. Doing it is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. Whatever I've ever done in my life, just whether it's giving talks, meditating, going out in the jungle meditating all night, or doing, live interviews,
on TV, even sometimes. I remember doing an interview and Ajahn Brahmani was with me. He wasn't actually in the studio, he was outside looking through the window. But the problem was, in those days, before you went in the studio, you had to do makeup first of all. Imagine how embarrassing that was for me. I was a man, I was a monk. I never had makeup on before. They told me I had to. And to make it worse, Ajahn Brahmani, you know Ajahn Brahmani, he was looking at me through the window, laughing at me. Ha! So much for friends. But doing it is easy, just you don't think about it. So whatever you do in your life, actually doing it is not that hard. Thinking about it, I can't do this, this is too much, I'm no good. Especially the I'm no good response. Who told you you were no good? Who said you can't meditate? Do you respect me and trust me? If you do, I hereby guarantee that you can all meditate. Ajahn Brahm told me I can meditate. Do you believe me? Some say yes, some say no. But anyway, that what is it? Time? I thought we were 11:30 or 10. I've got to go at 11. Oh my goodness. Okay, there we go. So anyway, doing stuff is easy. So, shall we meditate some more? Okay, we'll meditate some more, and after we start, I will vanish into my lunch hour. Because monks, we have to eat before midday, so I will vanish. But first of all, we'll do the meditation. Okay, so, up you get, stretch again. Is it too warm for you? Too cold? Just right? Good enough? Crikey, it's so quiet. It's a good job I'm not keeping noble silence. Otherwise, no one giving any talk at all. Okay. So when you are ready, you can sit down. And now just to get you going in a slightly different way, are you going with me to the lunch? Okay, well maybe, who can actually do the gong at 11 o'clock, 11:30? You do be the gong master? Hereby give you the gong and the bonger. It's a great responsibility I'm giving to you. So anyway. So sit down, close your eyes. With the eyes closed, you're going to bring attention to your body and relax it. Now, see if you can imagine that you are the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree in India, a couple of thousand or more years ago, sitting there enlightened, at peace, with nothing to do, nowhere to go, at peace, all your work finished, and sitting, just use imagination, visualization. Sitting on a soft cushion of grass under the shade of a leafy tree in a park by the banks of the river Nirantala, flowing down from the Himalaya mountains. You're sitting there at peace. No health concerns, no family problems, no work, no work to do, no worries about your finances or accommodation. You are an enlightened one, free, at peace. When you imagine, you can get a taste of what it must be like to have no wanting, nothing needed, nothing to run after, because you have everything and nothing. Imagine what it must be like to be an enlightened Buddha sitting under a tree, just watching the breath come in and go out. Nothing to achieve, nothing to get rid of. Peace, deep peace, forever. How does that feel? So I'm going to disappear. I'll see you after lunch.